Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, is Sir Chad Across the Universe, Riley.
Hey, hey, hey.
That's right, Chad is...
I'm a little here, I'm a little there, and I'm a lot everywhere else.
Sounds like the movie we're about to review. And speaking of which, also to this table, we have Mr. Spencer Purple Shirt Williams.
Hey, what's up, everyone?
He's actually wearing a purple shirt.
I am.
And it looks good.
Thank you.
It does. Actually, he wore that same shirt last time we recorded. I think that's becoming your recording show shirt.
Wow. Thank you for paying attention to my fashion choices.
Hey, someone has to. We got a creature.
Dang.
What?
We got a great show in stars. We're going to be talking about a recent film that dropped this past weekend, and that is Ava DuVernay's A Wrinkle in Time. So stick around as we dive into that. Chad, why don't you give him a little bit of info?
Yeah, that'd be nice, except I've got the wrong notes pulled up. Across the multiverse and in the blink of an eye, the Filmlosophers podcast is presented by Mingle Media TV and recorded live each week at VGB Studios. You don't have to bend the rules of space and time to subscribe to our podcast.
I saw what you did there.
We make it a lot easier than that. New episodes debut each Wednesday on Libsyn, Stitcher, Audioboom, Player FM, iTunes, and Google Play. Spencer, where else can they find us?
Whenever a new film leaves you feeling overwhelmed, underwhelmed, or just plain confused, tell us about it. You can join the conversation on Facebook at facebook.com/filmlosophers and Twitter at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. Current and previous episodes are always available on demand on our website.
We got a website.
Have a website.
I need you to do it.
Website.
Visit filmlosophers.com and catch up on anything you've missed.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen. We have a website. We are showing it proudly. Yeah.
Yeah. It's out there.
It's out there. We're excited. Like we said, we got a great show in store for you, and we're a little all pulled in different directions on this particular film in terms of where we stand, what we think, how we think, and let's hope that we can kind of make sense of it as we talk about it. That's right. We are talking about Ava DuVernay's A Wrinkle in Time. This recent Disney film dropped this past weekend, and it has been getting a lot of attention. It even got a little bit of an Oscar nod during the Oscars. When they actually did the whole... We talked about this last week when they went across the way to go and give snacks to people that were at a press screening.
Yeah, they went into a preview screening of A Wrinkle in Time and and gave them all the concessions. But more than the concessions, I think it was that a bunch of celebrities in fancy outfits like stopped the movie and came in and spent time with them.
Yeah. So, yeah, obviously this film has been on everybody's tongue, every critic's tongue. And everybody was pining for when the embargo went up last week, and the reviews were out, and they were all over the place, to be honest with you. And we like I said, we here have our own personal opinions.
As will our review be all over the place.
So, to get this thing kicked off, Chad, why don't you give us that official synopsis?
Sure thing. Meg Murray and her little brother, Charles Wallace, have been without their scientist father, Mr. Murray, for 5 years, ever since he discovered a new planet and used the concept known as a Tesseract to travel there. Joined by Meg's classmate, Calvin O'Keefe, and guided by the three mysterious astral travelers known as Mrs. What's-It, Mrs. Who, and Mrs. Witch, the children brave a dangerous journey to a planet that possesses all of the evil in the universe.
It's so great hearing you do that and then hearing the music behind it. And yeah, there's a lot of back-end stuff that we're just still figuring out, and this is so cool to hear it also. Adapted from the timeless novel written by Madeline Engel, the film is directed by Ava DuVernay, as we stated, and stars the young and talented Storm Reid, Levi Miller, and Derek McCabe. As well, it also stars some of the most well-known veteran actors such as Mindy Kaling, Reese Witherspoon, Oprah Winfrey, Chris Pine, Gugu Mbatha, and many others. That's right. I had been practicing how to say that name because I know you've been stuck on saying Gugu Mbatha.
True. I'm a big fan of the name and the performer. Yeah. I like her.
She's great.
She was great. She was, I mean, yeah, she was great in this film too as well, but she's a great actress. So A Wrinkle in Time marks the live-action filmmaking debut of screenwriter Jennifer Lee, who is best known for writing and directing films for Walt Disney Animation Studios such as Wreck-It Ralph, Frozen, Frozen Fever, and Zootopia. So like we said, this film had been on pretty much everybody's tongue. Everybody had been talking about it. Everybody had been hoping that this film was going to be a really great piece as the year begins anew, I guess, if you want to say. Because like we said, the Oscars just hit. Everybody's kind of on the post-Oscars kick. And, yeah, you know?
Yeah, I do know. Yeah, so we watched the Oscars, and then we went to this screening, and, well, now we're going to talk about it. I don't know. I don't want to start at the end before we even hit the beginning, but definitely this was a film that at the end of the screening, all three of us just sat there kind of dumbfounded and were trying to figure out what exactly we were going to want to say by the time we got on the mics and did this episode.
It was interesting because of the fact that this film kind of stood for a lot of what many people had been expecting as the next great step in diversity and the next great, you know, move towards creating a new type of filmmaking, if you will. Having somebody with the profile as Ava DuVernay, who has done really exceptional work. She's done a documentary called The 13th, which we have actually reviewed.
Yeah.
And she also did Selma. So she's got a history.
She's a very high-profile director
exactly
right now in the industry, which is fantastic.
And giving her a project such as A Wrinkle in Time was going to be
which
one of those...
Which is very different from what she's done before.
Completely different. Spence, had you actually read the book before we even got into the film? Had you been familiar with it at all?
No, my school apparently was super lame and we never read this book. So I came in with no expectations and no idea what the heck was happening.
At least you had an excuse. My school actually made me read it in fifth grade and I still didn't remember a single thing of it even now. Chad was the only one who had even probably the most freshest memory of the book.
Okay, can I just say, I was just looking at an entry online on Wikipedia talking about the book summary. And
did you say Wikipedia?
Wikipedia! I feel entirely vindicated by something that I told the two of you at the end of the movie.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Okay, so I read this book. I know I read this book in fifth grade because I remember the English classroom. I know it was fifth grade, and we had to act out scenes from the book, and in my group, I had to play Charles Wallace, who is the youngest sibling of the family.
Uh-huh.
And he's like 5 years old or something, or 7 or 8. I don't know. He's young. And so I remember having to walk on my knees. I had to put shoes on my knees and walk on my knees. And I remember it hurting my knees. But
wow.
I didn't tell you any of this after the movie.
No, you didn't. No,
it's just coming fresh to mind.
This is what torture does to you, psychology session.
No, I remember telling you after the movie, I must be thinking about the wrong story because the only thing I remember about this book, or I thought I remembered, that wasn't in this movie was there is a set of twin boys.
Ah, yes, yes, yes.
And I'm looking at this synopsis right here, and it says that there were twin brothers in between Meg and Charles Wallace. Now, they don't factor so much apparently into this book. This
the
is
larger story.
The first book in a series. You know, it's original book format. So the twins factor in apparently later on. I just remember that there were other kids in my class who were like, we were all family. Like when we were reenacting the scenes, there was a girl who was Meg. I was the little like Charles Wallace walking around on my knees. And there were two other guys in our group that were also siblings supposedly in the family. And I sat there in the theater afterward and I thought, well, I must have read a different book because I don't remember anything of what I just saw on screen. Mm. And the one thing that I feel like I do remember, aside from the youngest kid's name and walking on my knees and hurting them, is characters that didn't appear in the movie. So I must be mangling it. I was not mangling it. So
Chad has got a finger in the air, by the way.
I do. It's an emphatic point to the sky. I wasn't wrong. I thought I was wrong, but I wasn't wrong. Now, it doesn't change the fact that I don't remember a thing about this story, and the movie was completely unrecognizable to me.
You see, Spence, This is what torture does to somebody. It causes them to recollect in the most weirdest of moments. Chad, we will talk off the air and we'll have you lay on a couch.
You're gonna shut off my mic now, aren't you?
Hold on, what is this?
We can't do this.
No, it's true though. Like, because I've done some research. I actually was hoping to get a chance to read the book before we actually did the review, and ain't nobody got time for that. So I didn't get a chance to actually
read it.
Which
you're usually pretty good about, actually. I am. You do like to read the source material before we do the review.
I tried, but I didn't have the time. I couldn't get into it, and I was just, I didn't want to. So this film, this story, I did look at certain synopsis, and I do remember seeing something about twins. And it's weird because I've talked to several people already, and the one biggest turnoff, if you will, that a lot of them have when it comes to this particular film based on a novel that they've loved all their life, because it sticks better than it did to most everybody else, they say this is not really along the same lines as what they read, what they remember. And I wish I could speak to that, but I can't. But that goes kind of to the bigger conversation about the big argument that people have in terms of how closely do you create a film that has a source material as vast as a novel. I mean, I like the fact that when we talk about comic book movies, it's all subjective. Comic book slides are like art, and you can have a different iteration of it. You can visualize it a little bit differently. It doesn't go like you see a picture of Tony Stark, and he's got dark brown hair, eyes, he's got a suit, and you take that as inspiration and you create a film. You take something like, and I know we go back to this quite a bit, like the Hunger Games, the first Hunger Games, and like we said, we had a friend who was so upset after the first Hunger Games because in the book, the book explicitly explains in detail about a certain lamb plum soup, I believe it was.
Yes, it was a lamb stew.
It was a lamb stew. But it goes into, and she's a bit of a cook.
It goes into great detail about what Katniss loved about this stew.
Mm-hmm.
And so this friend of ours,
yeah,
who's a foodie, total foodie.
Total foodie.
That was the thing that she remembered the most out of the entire book,
mm-hmm.
and was wanting it to be a featured part of the movie.
We're, Spence, just to clue you in, we're talking about Camille, our friend Camille.
Okay.
So when this movie came about and she saw it and afterwards, that was her biggest complaint. They didn't do any justice to the stew. They didn't do any
literally the credits started to roll and she turned to the group and said, "Where was the lamb stew?"
Yep.
It was so important in the book. Where was the lamb stew? Mm-hmm. And we're all laughing because it's like, okay, well there was a stew. Like,
there was a broth. I mean,
there was a soupy substance. They just didn't take time to explain what it was.
And see, that's kind of part of my thought here is how we feel about novels who get translated into books as opposed to other source material. I mean, when it comes to novels getting translated, I think there's such a higher level of critique when it comes to wondering how closely they're going to be. But how? Here's my question to you guys.
Yeah.
How much should we police them in terms of how they differ from the source material? Should we be as forgiving as possible and say, well, you know what, it's one person's iteration of a beloved novel. It's their adaptation. It's how they perceive it. Or should we look towards the source material as kind of a mirror as to what we should see on screen? I mean, vice versa, what we should see on the screen as a mirror to the book. How do you guys feel about that? Chad, I'll start with you.
I think it depends on what it is and how much change somebody introduces. For example, not to overly harp on the comic book movie thread, but it's what we're very familiar with here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in the mainstream, you know, discussion at the very least. Something like Batman versus Superman, Dawn of Justice. There was a lot of uproar because it introduced a number of sort of new dynamics that were not completely reflective of what people were used to.
Yeah.
From the comics. Like, for example, Bruce Wayne / Batman is older already. There is a version, like that type of Dark Knight character comes from a very, very famous graphic novel.
Oh, yeah.
And yet, the elements of that story were not really present in Batman versus Superman. He was just kind of a bit of a grumpy maniac.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got also then all the way up to and including the introduction of a character called Doomsday which comes from a different storyline in the Superman comic books and
I'm
is also a high-profile, big bad guy character. Yeah. And he was kind of like a hastily put together,
science
powerful,
project.
Yeah, like lackey in this. And so people who are familiar, very acquainted, strongly acquainted with the source material, had issues. They liked the fact that these characters are being used, but the way that they were being used had a very noticeable disconnect from the source material mm-hmm. to the screen because they were kind of, it seemed like for that project, they were taking some of the most prominent and well-known and in some ways beloved parts of different storylines, jamming them together in a way that didn't really work, mm-hmm. and thus everybody loses in terms of, you know, your satisfaction level as a moviegoer. Not everybody, some people did enjoy it. And still, Wonder Woman and her guitar riff were extraordinary in that movie.
The best part of that movie. So you're saying...
But like a film like this, you've got... I mean, this book was written... It was published in 1962. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have generations, plural generations of people who have likely read this book, some of whom probably forgot it like we did, and others who really loved it and passed it on to their children. Yep. And who know it pretty intimately, in the same way that somebody might have encountered the Lord of the Rings series before the movies were ever made. And so you do, obviously, the movie runtime needs to be what it needs to be. You're going to drop certain elements out. You might overly promote other elements. It's interesting reading the synopsis. There's a lot of the main flow of the story that actually is pretty well preserved in this adaptation. There are a number of supporting details that are different, and there's a number of contextual information that has been modernized to fit like what our world today looks like mm-hmm. versus when the book was written in the 1950s and 60s. Mm. Just some, you know, the way that certain things were conceptualized or described obviously would have been different 50 years ago.
So you're saying it's pretty much dependent on the circumstance in the novel or in the source itself, like certain key events.
I think it depends on how much the creative team feels like they need to stay true to the source material.
Gotcha.
Because I think in certain cases it's okay to borrow a mood and change all the details.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just depends.
What about you, Spence? How do you feel about these novel adaptations and whether or not they should stick closely to the source material or if the artist or director should be free to paint a picture as he feels fit,
well,
he or
actually,
she feels?
I 100% agree with Chad because like he basically stole the words out of my mouth.
See, you have to ask Spencer these questions before
I got to start going left.
I thought you were going to turn off my mic.
I don't know how you.
I need to take
thing.
A nap. Okay, just turn it off.
All right,
but there's an example from like one of the Harry Potter movies. I forget which one. It's like 5 or 6. But there was a portion in like near the middle of that movie where the Death Eaters like attack Ron Weasley's house and burn it down for the most part.
Isn't that a Half-Blood Prince?
I think so.
I think it's Half-Blood Prince.
Yeah, that did not happen in the book and was super weird because it's like they just burned your house. Where do you live now?
Like, interestingly enough, the very next film, the home is like all brand new and back to the way it looked before. So I just say that because we just finished watching it this morning.
Yeah, it was really odd to me and stood out. And that's the thing I remember the most from the movie. So it's like things like that were like you have like characters acting like they would do that, but they wouldn't go out of their way to do that. And it's weird. It can't be weird if you're going to change something.
So what I'm hearing from the both of you is it's pretty much determined on key events in the source material, making sure the key plot points are that drive the main story from the novel. Those are translated at least well, equally well, or in the same dynamic.
Well, a perfect example from this film, A Wrinkle in Time, mm-hmm. is that there was a deliberate decision made, and I think it's a really healthy one, that the cast and crew, and well, not really, the crew, the creators decided to have a very a blended cast. And so you've got like Meg Murray and Charles Wallace Murray do not look the same.
No.
It's sort of implied that he is adopted. the way that the story plays out here. So it's not, I think it's just, it's a more expansive, embracing mm-hmm. kind of subtext. They don't ever really take a lot of time on screen to explain, we're adopting this child, and the reason is because of this. Like, they kind of just, in the beginning, they sort of tell young Meg, yeah, your brother's coming to us. And like, the mom is not pregnant in
no,
any way.
No.
He's coming, and you're going to meet him, and whatever. Like, he chose us or something. Like, it was presented in a very interesting way. And I'm sure if you're a big fan of the book and you're listening, you're like, yeah, that was covered in the book that way because he's not normal.
Right.
Yeah. I don't remember. It was 20 years ago that I read this thing, 25 years ago.
I have to agree to a certain extent with both of you guys, because I'm really big on creative interpretations and in doing so, actually portraying a decent a decent film based on a novel, like we were talking about Hunger Games. I thought it was good. I didn't have those little moments like Camille with like the food or anything. There wasn't anything like that stuck out to me overly well, as opposed to the grand picture of it all and how well it translated the larger picture. But then I blame you, Chad, because then you started talking about the Batman versus Superman.
Okay.
And that whole Dark Knight situation. And that is one of my favorite graphic novel series, the Dark Knight.
Right.
And that was my actual excitable only point about that entire film, and to see how it was translated, that like was like a knife to the heart. It's like that particular graphic series is such a great story, and the way it tells it and the way this film did it, or it tried to give homage to it, if you will, was like, no.
Oh my gosh. Ever since Get Out, you've been doing that no.
But but that type of thing, that type of creative interpretation of a source material, then you start recognizing, okay, I'm going to steer away from this, but I'm also going to still be respectful of the original source material. I'm still going to do this. Like, that whole way they did that, it kind of chafes my everything else in between, because it's a bug for me, because... Yeah, I loved that particular series, but the way that was portrayed, it was no.
You're
bueno.
Still talking about Batman versus Superman, right?
See, I'm gonna move on, right?
I'm like, you weren't chaffed or chafed by A Wrinkle in Time.
No, okay. Thankfully. But coming back to A Wrinkle, so as we started watching the film, obviously the expectations were a little all over the place. We weren't too sure what we were looking into. We didn't really remember much of the source material, and we had inklings of what may or may not to expect. But once the film got into it, you recognize, obviously, the main cast. You have Chris Pine, who's the father. As Chad was mentioning in the early film, you recognize the family dynamic, him, his wife. Go ahead, Chad. What's her name?
Gugu Mbatha-Raw.
Her. And then you have a younger version of Storm Reid's character, Meg, and the introduction somewhat of Charles Wallace. You recognize that he's been gone for 4 years, the father, after the fact. But it's interesting. I think the first... 5 minutes of the film really set the tone for the entire film, which, if we're being honest, I think that's what a really, really good movie will do. The first 5 minutes will always set the tone for what to expect for the rest of the film.
It's sure better.
And I think this was one of those films where you were like, okay, you see Chris Pine, you see him doing science experiments with his daughter. Okay, they're a science family. But then it begins to jump kind of these mental tracks in terms of, okay, we're talking about science and frequency, then we're talking about this, and then we're going to talk about, oh, the mother's coming in, we're going to talk about a kid coming in, is he going to like her, is she going to like him, in terms of the family dynamic. And I think the sporadic way that conversation was a pretty good representation as to how the rest of the film was in my mind. I don't know about you guys. Spence, what'd you think?
No, I'd agree with that, because there's certain points where Mrs. What's-It is just talking nonsense, and I'm not following what she's saying.
Now, Mrs. What's-It is Mindy Kaling's character.
Reese Witherspoon.
Reese Witherspoon.
Yeah. Mindy Kaling is Mrs. Who.
Mrs. Who. It's just like that old Abbott and Costello, you know, routine. Like, who's on first, what's on second?
And they did that a little bit.
Since we're talking about character names, Did anyone else had a problem remembering who was who? Like, besides, like, the misses, but, like, I had a hard time remembering what Charles Wallace's name was during the movie. So at one point, I thought it was Charles Henry. At another point, I thought it was Charles Xavier, but then I realized that that's Professor X, and that's not right.
You're jumping a little bit of a...
I think that was wishful thinking on your part. Yeah, I don't know. I felt like... I think with... there are certain things that some movies do, and typically they are genre movies. So this is like a science fiction fantasy style movie, but not not entirely. I mean, it is. The backdrop is science fiction and fantasy, but really the heart of it is not science fiction and fantasy. It's right. It's like a family story. I felt like they overused all the characters' names. Like, they always address each other by name. They are constantly not just saying... Not just like talking across the room at one of you. I would preface 70% of my comments with Eddie, comma, blah, 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 blah. Spencer, comma, blah, 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 blah. Like, all of them. Meg, Charles Wallace, Charles Wallace, Charles Wallace. Which, say that 10 times fast.
I
you're going to.
I feel like I heard that like, guy's name too much.
Just call him Charles or Chuck or Wally. I don't know. Like, whatever you want.
Was that trying to sound like the actual Wally?
Sort of.
Ah, that was good.
You know, but just they constantly used each other's names.
It's true.
And I think some of that is because of the genre terrain that they're playing. And they know that as the audience, you're taking all this visual stuff in. There's a whole fantastical element. And they're trying to sort of be kind of scientific at the same time. And yet there's a really, like, heart-grounded element of the story. So they know that you're paying attention to, like, eight different things at any given moment, and you don't understand what's happening with any of them. Quite frankly, it was, to me, a hodgepodge start to finish. And I don't know that that's... I don't know that... I can't say for certain that that's because the creative team didn't do a good enough job. I think that they were actually trying to remain faithful to the source material, and just reading through the synopsis that I've read through, it sounds... Like, they were pretty darn faithful to the story flow of the book. What a book has that a movie doesn't have, and this is true of any adaptation of any book, is that the book gives you time to kind of process the thought behind what's being presented to you, whereas the movie is just throwing stuff at you. You don't have, like, commentary. Like, the way that the sentence is put together tells you something if you're paying attention. Or it tells you what the character is thinking and not saying, which was a big thing that we've talked about before about The Hunger Games. Most of the first book of The Hunger Games takes place inside Katniss Everdeen's head. So translating that to the screen had to have been very difficult, because how she figures out how the game works and what to do to win and all that stuff and not just kill everybody. Like, the way that she thinks is what makes the book so good. The way that she figures things out and she pays attention to the promptings that Haymitch is sending certain gifts at certain times or withholding gifts when she needs it, and she knows that he's trying to send signals to her that way. That's what worked about kind of showing her as a brilliant mind. In addition to, you know, really good with a bow and arrow.
And that's one of the key things in terms of When you adapt a novel, you need to make sure, we just talked about this a second ago, you need to make sure that you're translating the most important part.
Yes.
And when it comes to...
Not all the noise, necessarily.
Exactly. It's not important to recognize, oh, by the way, her house was mentioned that it was purple in the beginning of the first chapter, and so they focused on the purple house and blah, 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 when there's a whole subsequence about focusing on the way her hair was flowing at that time, and there just happened to be a ripple right behind her, kind of thing. There's got to be a recognition of the finer values in a novel and translate that well enough on screen so that as you're telling the story, not only are you doing the director's interpretation of the story, but you're also allowing for the novel to be honored and respected. Without having to overly say, oh, well, we decided to change all this and then not recognize any of that, and so we're just totally doing something different. So I agree with you. I do. And it's, I don't know. This film really has my mind kind of all over the place.
I mean, honestly, I do think also part of my trouble with finishing the film and sitting there thinking, what am I going to say about this, is... there's a lot of attention that's paid to the spectacle of it, right? These new worlds that you're visiting and the, you know, great, you know, evil versus good, what wins out in the end, and like, you know, what does it mean to love somebody?
And don't forget all the costume design changes. I mean, costume changes.
Oh, yeah. Like a ton of costume changes.
I think that was just to kind of take a quick second from what Chad was saying. I think that was Spencer's first gripe as soon as the movie ended. Did you not see how that person's sweater was there all of a sudden on him, and then all of a sudden it's gone? What the heck was that?
I was very confused.
It was very Seinfeld stand.
No, like,
what about the blind food? What do you say about that?
No, Calvin, one of Meg's friends, question mark? Like, I'm still confused on how they really know each other, because he just shows up. But regardless, like, during the movie, he, like, loses a jacket and the shirt, but he has another shirt. And then all of a sudden, after the trip, he just has both of them back. And I'm like, where did, how did this happen?
It was all a dream.
Could be.
No, I'm just kidding. I don't know.
Yeah, very interesting. But I will say, one of the things I think that the movie did was it reduced a lot of complexity down to very simple statements.
Yeah.
Which I think would be very helpful to the young audience that it was made for. The young audience that the book appeals to.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's basically Oprah is the narrator, essentially, Mrs. Witch. And she says, yeah, there's a great evil. It's called the It. It's spreading through the universe. And the only way to combat the evil is with good, and we're looking for warriors of good. Like, yeah, that's very inspiring. These warriors are children, and it, so it's got to be very empowering to a child audience member looking at it, as long as you don't get too bogged down by kind of all the noise of everything.
Yeah, yeah. And I think if there's one thing that we can mention about this particular film, one of the common threads that ran from the beginning all the way to the end is that this film was completely and overly positive in terms of its ability to empower the viewer, whomever it may be. Watching this film, Ava DuVernay does a really good job of, like, subtly putting messages in the background of scenes, or putting images in the background. Like, there was something that had said women in history. It had something about, you know, women in there was a lot of little nods to the idea of women empowerment. Which is great, and not just for women itself, but for everybody. It can be a really positive message, and I think in terms of subtlety, I think that was one of the unique things that I could say positively about the film, that the film was positive. Yes, I just wanted to make sure I was saying that.
There were positive messages kind of subliminally almost hidden. Not subliminally, you can notice them. It's not like stuck between the frames.
Yeah, but it does take a bit of an eye to make sure, well, as you're, you know, scanning the screen, you're actually seeing, oh, that's cool. There's a sign in the background. And,
you know, I have to say, I think the biggest, I've thought about this quite a bit. It was several days ago that we saw the film,
mm-hmm,
versus when we're recording this episode. And I think a lot of times, like, looking at it more objectively, in retrospect, a lot of what I had an issue with were some of those creative choices, in the sense that sometimes, like, a scene just transitioned before it felt like it was fully over, or especially, we've talked about this a few times after the movie was over, some of the song selections just kind of, like, pop up and take over out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And you're like, what? That doesn't go with the feeling of the scene that came before that led into this. Like, suddenly there's, like, a song break.
Spence, what was the scene that you were talking about right before we went on the air?
Yeah, so there's a very particular one where they were Meg and what's his name, Calvin?
Calvin and Charles Wallace.
No,
well, Meg and Calvin. Charles Wallace was somewhere else.
Yeah, oh, okay. Like, Meg and Calvin had just escaped, like, this tornado monster thing, and then they refound Charles Wallace, and they walk a bit, and they're on a beach, and then a song starts, and it's like, yes, I am a warrior. And I'm like, what is happening?
Yeah, it was very, like, poppy, techno, whatever, and they're, like, wringing the water out of clothing, and it was very, and they're kind of having this sort of, like, he's admiring her and everything, and then it's just jarring. It didn't fit. Like, the message was good.
Yeah.
Because that was, you know, I was thinking, like, the messages of the songs were good. the messages of the scenes were empowering, but the way that things fit together was really just hodgepodgey.
Yeah, a lot of the way this film transitions from moment to moment, which, quick side note, that whole land tornado, whatever that was it just me or did that feel like really never-ending story-ish? Like, for me, I was watching it and I'm like, I'm just waiting for somebody to yell, Falcor! It just seemed really in that vein, and I think pretty much the gist of this movie made me feel like I was watching some iteration or a film that's in the same universe as Neverending Story. But yeah, the way it transitions over from scene to scene, it's really clunky. Like, by themselves, I'm pretty sure the soundtrack is remarkable. I'm pretty sure it has an incredible artist. Obviously, we were talking about it off air. They pulled Sade out of retirement to do a song on the soundtrack.
And I don't really think they should have.
Throwing shade on Sade. Look at you.
Well, I love her, but like, she didn't need to be in the soundtrack.
Wow. But the way they even the scene after, I mean, there's just every scene that seems to be a little bit more low-key and needing a bit more of a subtle approach to coming into the next scene. It had some interesting type of song that was either incorrect for the environment that they were in or was really high energy in a very low energy moment. And I think that was one of the biggest issues I had, one of them, when it came to enjoying this film as a whole. Because in pieces, and this is no disrespect to Ava or any of the team that made the creative choices they did, but as a whole, I felt like I saw 5 weeks worth of, or okay, 2 weeks worth of an hour special on ABC.
Sure.
You know, because it seemed like there was a piece, and then there should have been a commercial, and then a piece, and then there should have been a commercial, and then a piece, and then commercial, piece, and leave for the next week. You know, I don't know if you guys remember when ABC used to do those like family movie nights or whatever.
No, I remember those.
And so you would watch it and there would be, you know, breaks or, you know, the time when you had to go restroom or, okay, real quick and run to the bathroom, then come back and make it in time in the next 2-3 minutes. But that's what this felt like. And it even kind of looked like it, if you ask me. I mean, like I said, no shade whatsoever. I love what they're doing over there. But the way it even looked, it seemed like it was made for like an ABC family night.
Well, I think part of the reason maybe why you felt like that is because the movie does have very distinct transition periods where they're transitioning from one world to the next. Mm-hmm. And like, that's a great place to put a commercial.
Yeah, yeah, no yeah, doubt.
True.
So it's that particular type of clunkiness that I think really began the descent in terms of like the confusion of what we had when we were watching this. But I think one of the bigger things was in terms of the way the film points and the way it drives towards, I really had an issue finding the real threat. I don't know about you guys.
Thread with a D or threat with a T?
With a T. Like, I get it that there was a planet that was really bad, but I don't really know who was the villain.
The monster?
What monster, though? I saw the planet and I saw like this black goo, but I never saw, there was no way I could really unless we want to talk about, you know, the way the whole film kind of ends up and rounds about, it doesn't give me a definitive antagonist. I don't know about you guys. Am I the only one here that was kind of confused on that end?
Well, I thought it had more of a well-defined antagonist. I just thought the final battle fell kind of super flat.
Yeah.
Because I feel like, well, to me at least, the antagonist comes off as more of like a mental threat versus
right,
a physical threat. So it's not something...
I do believe in the book, and you can blame Wikipedia if I'm wrong.
Oh.
I do believe in the book the it is kind of displayed as an evil brain.
Which is kind of what I got the feeling from the last scene. Because
yeah, like, when they finally have that confrontation... It's like you're inside
the neural pathways.
Yeah, that's exactly what
dark neural pathways. So yeah, that. But I see what you're saying. There's no, there's sort of this how to say it. Most of the time, when you have a great evil, say you know the all-seeing eye, in The Lord of the Rings, when you have a great evil, you have lesser evils that you combat along the way.
Yeah.
And that's very much missing in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
They go to different places, but they're literally, I mean, the middle half of the movie, they are retracing what they believe to be the pathway that their father followed when he first tessered, which is what they call this whole using your brain to transport wherever you want in the multiverse. You just think it and you have a sound frequency and you do it and suddenly you're somewhere else. So it's very loose fantasy science, which has its own limitations. But again, it's a kid's movie, so it's okay. Like, yeah, it's fine. But there aren't any battles really that are being fought.
Mm-mm.
Along the way. They're just trying to retrace his steps. And then ultimately they end up on this planet, which has one of the funniest names. When Oprah said it, like, super serious face, and she's like,
Kamazots.
It's Kamazots. And the it lives on Kamazots, like in a very Oprah way, right?
Kamazots.
And Kamazots is the name of the planet where the it lives and spreads its evil out from. And so they make it to Kamazots, and finally you have like an antagonist for the first time, played by Michael Peña, who also is very light in terms of an antagonist.
Mm-hmm.
He has glowing red eyes, and that's about the worst thing about him.
Yeah.
Well,
and
he made
then,
the kids eat sand.
Well, that's true. And then the antagonist, one of the kids, becomes the primary an embodiment of the it, you know, the antagonist. And for that particular kid, I thought that was, in terms of start to finish, the performance, I thought the kid that played Charles Wallace had like totally stole the show for me because he expressed a range. His character required him at a young age to convincingly express a pretty wide range of emotions, and like he has an entire other consciousness that has sort of taken residence in his body. I thought that was, performance-wise, the standout for me was his work at the age of like 8 or something, or 6. I don't know how old.
Yeah, I'm not too sure how old he is
or was when they filmed it, but I was very impressed with that. Mm-hmm. However, you don't really have much antagonism. I mean, there's like a friend at school that is kind of a mean girl, and so there's some antagonism at school, but then once they start their journey, they're just sort of moving a while and doing weird things. Like, and the other thing that bothers me, and this is probably true of the book, is that if these Misses, so you've got Mrs. What's-It, played by Reese Witherspoon, Mrs. Who, played by Mindy Kaling, and Mrs. Witch, played by Oprah Winfrey, these Misses are like advanced beings, right? And they like go through extra ridiculous hoops to be as vague as possible with what they're saying, which I found very frustrating. And maybe that's because I'm an adult watching a kid's movie and kids are like, no, we totally get it. It's fine. But and it's probably the way that they're presented in the book as well. But there are just a lot of things about, okay, if you're an advanced race of beings and you're trying to empower warriors to take on ultimate evil, wouldn't you try to be clearer about what it is that needs to happen or how it's going to happen so that they're not just sort of fumbling around without a clue of what's going on?
Yeah, it's true. And I think I still, even though the actor who played Charles Wallace, Derek McCabe, even though he did a really stellar job as the child and even as the embodiment of the it itself, I don't know. I still think like there had to have been a bigger threat there. Like, Spence said, the entire final sequence of events that happens in the film kind of fall flat for me. But I think, like you were talking about Lord of the Rings, in the first film of the Lord of the Rings, you are aware of the threat. You are aware of the main antagonist. You're aware of the main antagonist's underlings, such as the Nazgul and the orcs and the Vorukhai and then Saruman. And you recognize all these other evils that work for the main evil, and they are as much,
there's a buildup,
exactly, and they are as much a physical threat to the protagonist as Sauron is, like more of an emotional or spiritual, even mental, because he's not a physical being. This, it was like, okay, you saw glimpses of the it's reach coming through in certain planets, but you never really saw what it did, or I mean, other than just turn the sky black. Spencer.
Well,
I'm like looking at you like you're in mid statement. I'm like, oh, go ahead, Spence.
No, I was just trying to think like, the movie's like implying that somehow this is the part where I was like, how does this work? I don't understand the rules of this universe, I feel like, is my ultimate problem with this movie.
Yeah.
Is that things are set up, like, I don't understand how Tessering works, like, because I know they said, like, oh, it's a sound, it's love, it's blah, but does that mean just, like...
it's love, it's blah.
It's love, it's blah.
But does that mean that now, like, anyone could just learn to just, like, mentally hum at the right frequency and then tesser somewhere?
Heck yeah.
Like...
I'm going to the bookstore, Mom. Okay, make sure to hum at 48 kilohertz.
Yeah, so I have a bit of a problem with like how everything works in this movie. But like specifically regarding it affects people's mental states even from a distance, because like there was a montage during this movie where it's like showing how like it's negatively affecting people on Earth without directly being there.
By spreading jealousy and anger and hatred and for oneself and other people. And I'm like, well, I think we're doing a good job on that all on our own. We don't really need its help, but still.
Yeah, because then it's like, where do we stop and the it begins? It's very confusing.
Well, and there is a thing, and I'm going to tread lightly because, dear listener, I don't know where you stand on certain topics, and I don't want it to distract from the overall flow, but I believe... I believe that the book itself, there's a lot of specifically Judeo-Christian philosophy that is at play in the book that is more broadened and generalized in this movie adaptation.
Oh.
And so there are some things that might have read more clear and easier to decipher, in the book format than the way that they're telling the story here. Again, when you're adapting something and you're trying to, let's say, enlarge the mindset or appeal to a broader audience by pulling in different cultural references, which there, on the surface, there's nothing wrong with wanting to... We've talked a lot recently about representation of certain cultural backgrounds, and there's nothing on the surface that's wrong about that, but... If some of the underlying structure of the story kind of really anchored definitively to like a Judeo-Christian mindset of good and evil and how that operates and functions, I think some of the loosey-goosiness of the physics of Tessering and like how everything, it's all love. And like, I suspect if we did go back and reread the book, there might be some more definitive touch points and anchor points in the original story that were loosened up a little bit in the movie so that it wouldn't turn anybody off. And it would feel like it more broadly applies to a variety of worldviews. And I think that maybe it's a hypothesis of mine that maybe that watered down some of the kind of the logical, oh, I know what you're telling me. I know what I'm looking at. Yeah. It's a fantastical environment, but it fits because you're actually connecting it to this other very specific, you know, narrative that's part of the popular consciousness.
I think that makes a lot more sense in my mind now that you've brought in that perspective. But here's the bigger question. Since they're using a Tesseract, does that mean that they are now a part of the Marvel Universe since they are owned by Disney?
Okay, wait. I thought they were part of the Cloververse because it's Gugu Mbatha-Raw and she's a scientist who has two kids. It's all together.
And this is the universe where she actually stayed home instead of going on the trip.
There's an energy crisis other places in the world and it's coming.
Veto. Just straight.
Mind blown. Veto. Wow. There you go. That actually makes a lot of sense now. Thank you. I was going with the whole Marvel bit, but you went over here with the whole Cloverfield thing, and that works too.
No, like, I was like watching the movie. I'm like, so she played a scientist recently in two different movies?
Hey.
I was like, that's interesting.
Just got to pay the bills. There's another conspiracy theory in terms of film.
Oh boy.
That
I always love these, he says while shaking his head.
There is a theory that the Wrinkle in Time universe written by Madeline Engel back in 1962, that the Stephen King universe is actually in that universe.
I heard this one.
There's a YouTuber by the name of MatPat.
Yeah, I was watching that too.
who does something called Film Theory on YouTube, and he actually has a really convincing video as to why the Stephen King universe is actually in the Wrinkle in Time universe. And not just based on the main antagonist being named as It, because he highlights...
But mainly. Not entirely, but mainly.
He highlights, even in the book, he shows excerpts of the book where it shows the creature actually being named It in capital letters, and the creature in the movie and book, It, is actually referred to as It several times until they actually find out his name, and even after the fact, it is still recognized as It. How the warriors against this evil are a bunch of kids with positive energy, and the way they defeat it in the book is by love and positive energy. And even when they come back 22 years later, they still fight him with love and positive energy and destroy him. And I don't know, guys.
So what other parts of the Stephen King verse does it connect to? Because that you just said it's not really all It, but like everything you just said is the book It. So what other elements of the Stephen King verse does The Wrinkle in Time connect
stating
to?
That it connects to that verse, then
I mean they're both set up as multiverses.
Exactly. So that, I mean that could traverse into
is the Cloverfield.
The cosmic being like this evil entity, the main antagonist in a lot of the, like in the Dark Tower novel series, is this alien cosmic entity that is this large evil known as the It in the books. So I'm just saying.
I'm not going to lie. I really zoned out.
Yeah. Chad is having there. None of this.
Well... Okay, we're done with conspiracy theory. But so to kind of boil this down, one of the things that I just wanted to touch on before we kind of close this thing up is we mentioned that this film obviously is produced and made by Disney. So there's got to be a little bit of a recognition, I guess, for the demographic that it is targeting, which is children. And if we think about it, I mean, I wrote about this last week when I was writing down my thoughts. And one of the things that really kind of came to mind was, if you guys remember when we were young, there were movies such as like
there was a movie called The Land Before Time. There were like 27 of them or something ridiculous.
But like the Neverending Story, you had movies like Secret of Nim, you had movies like The Dark Crystal, you had all these interesting. I mean, even Labyrinth. There were all these crazy movies that were targeted for kids. And as a kid, I loved most of those movies. Like, Labyrinth gave me nightmares galore, but all the rest of them were, like, great. But I'm pretty sure to the adults, to my parents, to probably your parents as well, they looked pretty stupid. Like, okay, a bunch of Muppets looking for, you know, a crystal or whatever. It's probably not in their wheelhouse. And it makes me think, you know, in terms of the way we look at this film and the way we see it, and obviously we're critiquing the film from film critics' perspective, from our perspective as avid moviegoers and recognizing, you know, the way that we just see movies ourselves. We individually absorb them. But then it does make me think about, you know, how this film would be absorbed by a child, how this film would be recognized in that matter. And as much as I didn't really have that much enjoyment watching the film, visually, I'm pretty sure a kid could be pretty entertained for about the hour and 40 minutes that they're in there.
Oh, in
my mind, I mean, it's got enough to kind of keep them engaged.
And I mean, it's always something to make sure that you're considering, who is this made for? We obviously get to see a lot of movies over the course of a year, and not all of them are made for us as our audience. Thankfully, there are a lot of comic book movies, so a lot of them are. But a movie like this, I mean, it's very easy to recognize this as a kid's movie. as a movie meant to appeal to and empower young people. And that you can totally respect. I think that there's a lot about the main character's story, Meg. We didn't talk very much about her, but her story arc, you know, like she has the trauma of her father disappearing. She's bullied at school and belittled. Kids are telling her, oh, he left you because you're not worth being around. That's why he left. Like, there's a lot of serious stuff that you know actually does happen for a lot of kids in their lives. And she's got a very cynical mindset. She doesn't believe that he's dead. She doesn't believe that he left his family. She doesn't know how to find him. And, you know, she's got the cynicism. She's a bit of a troublemaker sometimes at school, standoffish and suspicious. And ultimately, over the course of the story, it's her story because she's the one that needs to change the most, right? Charles Wallace kind of, in some odd clairvoyant way, already knows who all of these creatures are, and he knows that they're going to take them on a journey to find their father and all this stuff that he shouldn't know, but he does. And Meg has to go on the journey, and she has to learn, you know, her balance, and she has to learn how to love again in some ways. And that's a good story to tell, you know, kids who are trying to deal with a really complicated, complex world that we as adults have had a hand in kind of screwing up.
True.
And not helping to, you know, safeguard certain things that we find valuable for children to still have, like love, imagination, acceptance, and respect.
Yeah, and that's a really great note to kind of end this conversation off of. And with that, let's go around the table. Spence, is this a pass or fail, and how many monocles?
Let's go with a pass because, you know, it's a movie that does make sense, and it might not be for me, but I feel like there's a lot of kids out there who would probably like it. So, yeah, passes, and I'll give it a 3. Like, they did a great job on, like, diversifying the cast, and it's amazing to look at.
Chad?
I like that. That's a very fair response. I would say Child Chad, I would probably have passed it and given it, like, a 4. I feel like Child Chad would have understood, would have just like gotten it a little bit better and not cared about the details. Adult Chad, I would say it's on the borderline of passing and failing. I'll pass it kind of for the reasons, Spencer, you mentioned, and I'd probably give it a 2. Didn't really appeal to Adult Chad very much.
I think for what this film sets out to do in terms of creating a diverse cast, a diverse interpretation of a film that... in the original novel, the family was predominantly white, and creating a colorful cast, not just in the family, but also in the cosmic entities of Oprah.
Cosmic
Oprah. I will pass it for that, for the sake of what it's doing and what it sets out to do, and hopefully what it creates in terms of a goal for other filmmakers. In terms of how many monocles, I am going to give it 2.5, just because I really did like the performers. The younger performers are definitely the highlight of the film for me, and I am anxious to see in what future projects they actually plan to put them in. So, because we know it definitely won't be the sequel to this one. So before we go, we're going to let you know of a couple upcoming weekend releases. We got Tomb Raider, all you video gamers out there. This film is debuting this Friday, so...
That's right. Lara Croft is back.
So check it out. If you have any thoughts on this review or any other previous review, drop us a line on our Facebook page at facebook.com/filmlosophers or our Twitter page at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. This was a great conversation. Obviously, we here at the Filmlosophers, we love film. We love filmmakers, and we love the idea of what film can achieve. So we hope you guys all understand... When we talk about films like this, we are looking towards the more logical aspect and the more technical aspect and even some of the creative choices. But altogether, we absolutely adore film and filmmakers and where filmmaking is going right now in the industry. So just want to state that out there. So from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Chad.
I'm Spence.
Class dismissed.